And then the people on the left, they only recognize the kind of racism that is not theirs. They only recognize what they think of as right-wing racism. They never look inward and think, well, what things are we doing on the left that are actually really quite racist? Like insisting that all of us black people vote on the left, or insisting that all of us black people hold certain values. Like, why can't we have the freedoms of white people to be able to think the way that we want to think?
Welcome to Conversations with Peter Boghossian. I'm at Makayla High School in London, and I'm absolutely blown away. I just wanted to say my impressions around the school to give some specifics before we begin the interview. I was amazed at the level of discipline when I walked around. Everyone called me sir. Everyone called the teachers sir, opened the doors for me. They were incredibly thoughtful, incredibly well-spoken. It has been an extraordinary experience. I could not fathom a high school in the U.S. performing at this level at any stage. And I'm excited to interview the headmaster, Kathleen Birbelsung, today about the experience at Makayla and how she's managed to create such an extraordinary environment here. This astonishing educational experience is testimony that we can help our kids achieve. You nervous?
No.
Good, fine. Good. Okay, great. Catherine, thanks for coming on Conversations with Peter Boghossian. I appreciate it. You have created something extraordinary. You're headmistress here at Makayla, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm utterly blown away. You've created something extraordinary. So let me start by asking you, tell me about how many students do you have here?
Just over 700.
And their backgrounds are, what are their backgrounds?
Yeah, so we're an inner city school in Wembley in London with a typical inner city intake. So we're a free school. So the equivalent in America is a charter school, but actually we're just like a public school because we don't choose our intake. So okay. The kids who come here are just the local kids from the inner city, as you would find in any of the local schools here.
So 700. So I'm blown away. So we had a tour. Two of the kids gave us a tour, mm-hmm. and we walked into various classrooms. How on earth did you manage to create an environment? So yeah. We walked in, no one looked at us, and yeah. then not even the teachers looked at us, yes. and the students were so focused, everybody raised their hand in unison, their hands went down in unison.
Yes.
Like, how did you create that environment?
Yeah, it's funny, because I have a friend who works at one of the local schools, and he's been there for over 20 years, and he came to visit, and he asked all the kids what elementary schools they'd come from, and he came bursting in here at some point and said, I don't understand. They've all been to the same schools. They're just like our kids. What have you done to these kids?
Exactly.
He said, you know?
Yeah.
Now, it's because I think we as Westerners often underestimate how much influence we can have on children. In the East, they understand that adults help to shape who the children will be. Here in the West, we sort of think, well, you're either born a good mathematician or you're not, or you're born a nice kid or you're not, you know? It's not true. And so children, like all human beings, adapt to the culture around them. And our expectations, look, I mean, we do a behavior boot camp when they first arrive in year 7. So that's when they're 11 years old. And we teach them how to behave the Makayla way. But the main thing I'd say is you have your detentions for naughty stuff, and you have consistency from all of the staff. And you have excellent teaching, and that is something I think people don't realize, that there's good teaching and there's bad teaching, and then there's really excellent teaching, and all of my teachers are excellent, and we're all training each other all of the time so that we get better and better. The kids don't turn around because they're used to seeing guests. We get 800 visitors here every year from all around the world, mainly teachers who come to see what we're doing because they've heard these amazing things about the school, just really through word of mouth on social media and so on. And so the kids are used to people coming into their classroom, so they don't really notice it. And it's also the case that nobody would turn around because, well, nobody does it. And It's just not the done thing.
So they raise their hand in unison, and then they put their hand down, and then the teacher will say, you call them teachers?
Yep.
The teacher will say something, and they talk to each other about something.
Yeah. Now, I mean, you saw a particular thing. So it's not that they're raising it in unison. It's that they all know the answer to that question. So that's why they're all answering. Right. But you might have gone into another classroom and not seen everybody raise their hand because they didn't all know the answer to the question. And that would be a question that they were given. We call them bogglers, questions that, you know not everybody's going to know the answer to. When you were in that particular classroom, they were being given questions where the teacher knew, come on, everybody, you're all with me. They're picking up the pace. They're picking up the energy in the classroom.
The energy, that's the other thing. Yeah. Just so many questions. Okay. So how did you get these particular teachers? I mean, not everybody could do that. It seems to me to be a specialty, a subspecialty.
Well, they are brilliant, but none of them knew how to do that when they arrived. We have to train them into being a Michaela teacher. So, and it's hard when they first start. It's really hard. And I have to give a lot of pep talks to them saying, look, everybody here was where you are now. I know you feel it's difficult, but I promise you in 2 months' time, you're going to be feeling a lot more on top of it, etc. We give them a lot of support and a lot of advice on telling them precisely what to do so that we can get that consistency. Children love consistency and they love predictability. People think that that stops children from being creative when actually the opposite is true. It's when children feel safe that they're able to push the boat out and ask questions when they're not sure.
Right.
It's, when they're able to try out new ideas and new thinking. So if you want your children to be independently minded and to think for themselves, you really do want an environment where the discipline is good and where the teaching is excellent.
I want to get back to the teachers, but
yes.
At lunch, there's a topic that you center the conversation around, and the topic was lying. And they used a wonderful example of George Santos, who's the paradigmatic pathological liar, who lies literally about everything, even things of no consequence whatsoever. And so we talked about lying. And then I asked the kids, are there ever circumstances in which you could lie? And they gave some wonderful answers, like if you were taken hostage and they wanted to kill people. And I was just so taken aback by the focus of the table and the seriousness about which they took everybody's point. And
That's been taught.
Yeah.
So every time they have lunch, they're given a topic. They're always sat with those children. They each have a role. It's family lunch. They serve the lunch to each other.
They wipe up
afterwards with a cloth. There's a sense of being part of a family. And then they know that when they have their topic, they're meant to discuss the topic. So they've then got used to the idea of collaborating together, talking, over lunch. We all take for granted the skill of being able to cut your food and look at the other person and chat to them.
Right.
That's something that they're learning every day. And it's also just a lovely part of the day where they eat lunch and break bread together.
Right. Okay. So you have to help me. As an American, I'm having trouble with this.
Oh, no, people have trouble with it here, too. Don't think that schools like English schools are not like this. We're the only school in the world like this. We're very odd.
Yeah, I've been to a lot of high schools around the world, actually. I've given talks to a lot of high schools around the world, and I've never seen anything like this. Literally, I've never seen, and Reed and Travis and I were looking at each other when we were in the classrooms, just astonished. Like, okay, so let's, I just need help understanding this. So,
it's really great that you're so interested and blown away by it because, some people come and say, this is interesting, Catherine, and they don't like it. They don't like the order. They don't like the structure. And I think order and structure is good for children.
To those people, I would ask what the alternative is and how do you assess those outcomes?
Exactly. And whenever anyone points to our results, which are, of course, the last 2 years, we've had the highest progress 8 is the way in which schools are judged in this country. We've had the highest score for the last 2 years in the whole country. That's out of some 4,000 secondary schools.
Right. And I want to drill down this because it's really important. So just again, you're talking about, so I saw primarily minority students, many, many Muslim students.
Yeah. They're all minority.
Okay. One or two.
Eastern European kids.
Oh, okay. Okay. So virtually all minorities, if not all minorities, from the community. It's open enrollment, so you don't self-select the smartest.
No.
And yet you produce those outcomes.
Yeah.
So by definition, that means that if this were replicated, and I see no reason, given that there's a mechanism behind this, that this couldn't be replicated, that you could achieve that anyone who wants to replicate that would achieve similar ends. So there must be a political reason. There's no pedagogical reason why it can't be replicated.
No.
So there must be a political reason why it's not replicated.
Yes, that's right. There is. We have tried to set up a primary school, an elementary school. We were not allowed to do so. We tried to set up a leadership program.
Allowed by who?
By the government. So I know in America you all can kind of just set up charters and you Pretty get much. Money. And we can't do that. We have to go through government. So government would not allow us to do that. Then we tried to do a leadership program, which would have given... Well, leadership advice to various schools on how to copy us and what to do. We were blocked in doing that. We then got quite far along in trying to set up another secondary high school. And then COVID happened. And for various reasons, that all fell apart. So I've sort of given up on trying to expand the school because I have tried. And this is, I might add, under a conservative government here in Britain.
That was my next question. Was it blocked by the right or the left?
Well, it was under a conservative government. And what's hilarious is that people always say that the conservative government are backing us. Well, I haven't found that at all. I found quite the opposite. Now, of course, it'll be interesting when Labour get in, because Labour are about to come in now. And, you know, they, well, if this is what life was like under the conservatives, I would very much worry about what life will be like under Labour.
Why?
Well, because we are not progressive. We're very traditional. What we prove, I always think of us as like the show pony for schools. And all of these teachers who come from all over the place, including Chicago, New York, all kinds of teachers come. They copy what we do. And we have changed things in a number of schools. I see using a number of our methods, which is great because we have had impact on schools across in Australia, in New Zealand. I mean, this is, you know, across the Western world, we've had impact.
You said methods. What are the Michaela methods? What methods are they trying to?
So what are the methods? So we consider ourselves to be traditional. Progressives are very relaxed when it comes to behavior. They see children to be parts of different victim groups. So they'll say, okay, you're in the black group, you're in the LGBT group, you're in the Muslim group, you're in the whatever group.
Yeah.
And they teach children to identify with that and to see the world through the victim's eyes. We, on the other hand, push very much this idea of working hard and being kind. That work hard, be kind, actually, we stole from the American KIPP charter network.
Yeah, yeah.
They used to have a motto called work hard, be nice.
Kind is a much better word.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we changed it because we didn't want to have the exact same motto. But yeah, they've actually been stopped from having, I don't know if you know this, but they've been prevented. So after George Floyd, they came under attack for being racist, for having this motto. Because if white teachers teach black children to be nice, that means you're teaching them to be subservient and therefore it's racist. And KIPP then took their motto down. Now, there's no way I'm ever taking our motto down because I think it's right to teach children to work hard and be kind. And at the very least, you manage to get all your children to be those two things, then brilliant. Obviously, you want them to be able to do more than that, but you want them to have resilience, to persevere, to be stoical, to keep on going when it gets hard, working hard. And then you also want them to be kind, nice people. You know, working in the inner city all my life, and my teachers will also tell you where they've worked, if a child were to drop a plate in the canteen, in other schools, what happens is, that's what happens, yeah, to kind of humiliate the child who's dropped something. If it happens here, 5-6 children run to help them pick up what they've dropped. I've seen children put their hands into wet lasagna on the floor to put it back on the plate, you know, because they're trying to help their classmate. And I just think it's really important that children be brought up in that way across racial and religious divides. So our children have backgrounds from all over the place. We've got Muslim children, Hindu children, Jehovah Witnesses, all types. And we very much create an environment and socialize them into being able to get on with each other.
Okay, so I'm having a hard time. So who on earth is against this?
Well, everybody.
Okay, talk me through it.
Okay, so, all right. So people who don't like it, they would come and say, How come there's silence in the corridors and all the kids do is say good morning and good afternoon to their teachers? How come they're not skipping along talking about Aristotle? And when I say, you know, the thing is, inner city kids don't skip along talking about Aristotle. What they do is they punch each other in the head and run screaming down corridors, whacking each other, and little kids get trampled on and so on and so forth. Now, I've done this all my life. I know what corridors look like in inner city schools. But unfortunately, I think a lot of the people making decisions have never been in an inner city school. They have no idea what they're talking about. They have no idea what's happening on the ground. So I've spent my life trying to get people to understand what is happening in these schools. But nobody seems to care, mainly because they don't care about these kinds of kids. And what they care about, I would argue, is looking like they are good people, seeming like they are good people. So they put black boxes up on Instagram and they say, I'm an anti-racist. I always think when these people are attacking me on Twitter and so on, well, what do you actually do? What do you do every day? Because every day I'm in work at 6:45 a.m. and I've been doing this for over 25 years. And I've been changing the lives of kids in the inner city who come from poor backgrounds, who just want a chance in life, you know? And the only way these kids are going to get a chance in life is if they get an education. And I know how important school is. I think a lot of people don't realize how important school is. And they just think you're either born with the brains or you're not and that sort of thing. As opposed to, there is so much that we adults can do to influence a child and shape who he's going to become. And all the problems that you see both in America and over here, where adults, either illiterate or innumerate, functionally, I mean, or different groups that have been created where people cannot get on with each other and they hate each other. That's happened because of what takes place in schools, right? And people don't seem to realize this. Exactly. They don't realize how important schools are. And I know that the conversation is people talk about what's happening at the universities, but the reason why the kids at the universities are so easily manipulated is because they've already been completely brainwashed when they're at school.
Okay, so going back to the faculty you have here, the teachers, to teach here, you have to have a teaching certificate.
Yeah, I mean, look, my teachers are very bright and very good. So I have teachers who've been to Oxford and Cambridge. I've got teachers who've been to the next grade level university down from that. They're very good. But the thing is, you could do this stuff anywhere. Really. Now, it might not be exactly the same, you know, maybe not all the kids would be putting their hands up, as you saw, but you would transform. I've heard from other head teachers out there, from people. So I've been doing some work with a school in the Bronx, which is a charter school called Vertex Academies.
Oh, yeah.
And Ian Rowe is set it up. And I've been doing some work with him. And I went in there and saw X, Y, and Z and then gave some advice. The place has got so much better with just following the advice that I've given them. You know, these things work. And to be honest, we're not the only ones. There are other schools that take some of these ideas, make that happen. So when I say take some of these ideas, the adult should be the authority in the room.
Okay. I'm just going to ask, okay, so adults are the authority in the room.
So what I mean by that is, you know, the friends of yours who might be parents and they want to be friends with their kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't really know how to discipline them. They don't tell them off. Yeah. They don't punish them and praise them and so on. Even the word punish these days is considered to be a bad word. You can't say it. First, it was punish. Then they moved to sanctioning kids. Then they moved to correcting kids. Now they talk about consequences for kids. Over the years that I have been teaching, these words have changed because it's simply unacceptable to discipline a child, which is crazy. It's not like you're beating them. You know, you give them a 20-minute detention. What's the big deal? Or if you're a parent, you make them sit on the naughty step, or you tell them that they're not allowed to use their phone that night, or whatever it is. We have to be adults. We've lost adult authority in our society in the Western world, I think, these days. It's also the case, so adult authority. Then there's the curriculum. So everybody's going around decolonizing their curriculum everywhere. We haven't done that. I mean, it's the case.
What do you mean by decolonize?
Okay, so it's not that we don't read any books by Black authors. We do. It's not that we don't include Black people in our discussion around British history. So a million soldiers gave their lives from India in the Second World War. We wouldn't teach the Second World War without mentioning that, for instance. But what we don't do is teach a whole unit, which would be 6 weeks or longer, on the Black Tudors. Because there were a few Black people in Britain during Tudor times, but it doesn't warrant 6 weeks of study. So we might mention that Henry VIII had a trumpeter called John Blank and he was Black, yes, but we wouldn't spend all our time on these issues. And that's because we think we want to teach children British history and chronologically. So history is often not taught chronologically anymore. So children have no real grasp of where they're coming from. We teach British history to all of our children because it is their history. People might say, I think both on the right and the left, oh no, they're not white, therefore they're not British. But I believe very much that they are British. And this idea that they're actually from somewhere else, Nigeria or Ghana or, you know, United Arab
States. I was going to say United States. We'll take that.
UAE is what I'd say. You know, the fact is that our kids, their parents may be from somewhere else, their grandparents may be from somewhere else, but they very much should be taught British history. We sing God Save the King. We sing other hymns or songs like that, that represent the country. And the reason for that is that we're multicultural, but we're all under the same umbrella of being British. And that's important because, I mean, in America and here, we see all kinds of discord and division between different groups. And I think that that is
manufactured.
It is exactly in the schools.
Totally.
Because everybody's asked, how do you identify?
Yeah.
As opposed to, well, I'm actually British and I'm human. And this is what we share together. So we have all of our children living together here in the school, being friends with each other across those divides, because it's what we believe in. We just don't do the kinds of things that other schools do, which divide children, I think. I think it's good for children to care about each other across those divides.
Okay, so many people watching this won't have an understanding because they didn't have the tour. And even when I read about the school, I still couldn't, like...
Yes, it takes visiting. I always say to people, you need to come and see it.
It really does. It really does.
Well, there is a documentary about us, which might, you can find it at headmistress, what is it? Strictestheadmistress.com.
Oh, is that you?
Yes, that's me.
The strictest headmistress.
Yes, and the producer, she set it up on this website. So people can watch it. What that documentary does is it does allow you to see the kids, to see some of the teaching, to get a feel for it. Because when you just read about it, it's true. You can't know what it's like.
Okay, so walk us through for like a minute or two. The kids come in at what time, and then what do they do? And I noticed there's a little room for the phones. They put the phones in, and walk us through.
I don't know what you mean by room.
There's like a room.
Oh, that's digital drop-off. So, okay, first of all, they're not allowed phones in the school at all.
Okay.
Well, I say they're not allowed. If we hear them or we see them, we take them. So if you have a phone and we never hear it, never see it, fine. And because everything's so orderly, we just never see phones. It just never happens. In other schools, gosh, the kids are going around with their earphones on, with their phones. So not only do we say no to phones in the classrooms here and the corridors, but the digital drop-off that you saw is actually us encouraging them to get rid of their phones for a whole week or a couple of days. So they build up to it. I'm going to do it tonight. I'm going to give them my phone. Oh, I spent the whole evening, miss, without my phone. Okay, why don't we try it for 2 nights now? See if you can do it. And then coming up towards exams, kids are giving in their phones because we've got exams, internal exams happening in 10 days' time. So they're giving in their phones because for 10 days, they're going to go without their phones. And there's a real sense they all understand how bad phones are for everything, for their mental health, for their exam results, for the growth of their brains. There are all kinds of studies done that show that if a toddler is on a phone, I can guarantee you he's never going to become a reader. Like, he may read, he'll never love reading. It's impossible. And parents don't realize this. They give their children these phones and they don't know, you know, Social Dilemma, which was on a film on Netflix. Kristen Harris, exactly. You know, they were whistleblowing, trying to say, look at what we're doing. And they weren't even talking about kids. They were talking about adults. So people just don't know. And they give their kids these devices because they're great babysitters. Let's face it. Parents want a bit of a break. They give them a phone. The kid goes quiet. But they don't know what the trouble they're storing up. Every crazy person out there, every pedophile, every gang member, they all have access to your child. They know what their favorite food is and their where they go to school and their walk to school and who their friends are and everything. And there are children who have been murdered, not our children, but I'm just saying there have been children who have been murdered. There are mums out there. There's an American mum, Breck Bednar. She brought him up here. He was murdered because she allowed him to game online. And I mean, and by the time she went to the police, he had been so taken in by the groomer. Yeah. There was nothing the police could do. So the thing is, people don't realize the danger they're putting their children into. But there's also the brain, the breaking of the brain,
yeah,
which just makes them more stupid.
Jonathan Haidt has been
he's great. So everything that Jonathan Haidt is saying is absolutely spot on.
Yeah.
I have the experience of it anecdotally. I can tell you, I see it here. I can tell you for nothing. The kids who go up in terms of the set that they're in, academic sets, because we have four sets, top to bottom. The ones that go up never have a phone. The ones that come down are always on their phones.
Interesting. Okay.
It's fascinating.
Okay. So walk me through the day. What time do the kids get in?
So they get in just before 8, and then they're here till 3:15. They have 6 lessons. They have a break in the morning, and then they have lunch. Lunch, of course, is this orchestrated event, which saw, which is family lunch. They are normal kids. They learn tons. I remember once we had a white middle-class kid who joined us here. So they're very rare. And when once in a while they come, he was actually the son of a elementary headmistress somewhere nearby. So he came to us, and he came to us in year 8. So the kids had already been here for a year before he arrived.
Yeah.
And I saw him going down the corridors in his single file as we walk, and he was crying. And I pulled him to the side. I said, "What's going on?" And he said, "I've never had to concentrate so hard. I've never had to work so hard in all my life.
Yeah.
I can't cope with it." And I said, in true Michaela fashion, "Pull yourself together. Come on, you can do this." Put him back in the line. Off he went. And you know, over his time here, he moved from the 4th set to the top set. He became a guide, one of those kids who took you around.
Great, yeah.
He became a future leader. He was just excellent. I mean, he got much better results than he would have got somewhere else, but also the kind of person that he is, you know? That's the thing I'm always most proud of, is who they are. Yeah, and it's such a nice place to be. You don't see this often in inner cities, especially in America. Your public schools are just on fire.
They're a disgrace, yeah. One thing that I noticed is that at the end of the exercise at lunch, we did the appreciations and then the two claps. And they went around and they talked what they were, grateful for, basically, what they appreciated.
That's it.
And I was so touched by the things they were grateful for. I was so just taken aback by that. And then at the end, the person leading the exercise called one person from each table, and the kids stood up and they pushed their chair in and they projected their voice and they said, you know, like, I won't say her name, but this one little girl who gave us the tour said that she said it's a small thing, but I'm really thankful for the timers that they give us, because it enabled us, we had these guests, enabled us to get on time. And I mean, just the things that there is something about gratitude that I also don't see.
So we actively teach them gratitude. You know, you'll find in every self-help book that they tell you to write down things that you're grateful for at the end of the day so that you're a happier person. So they actively stand up, as you say, and they demonstrate gratitude publicly. But we also encourage them to do it privately. One, because they'll be happier, but also because they're going to be better people.
Right.
So that they don't go around seeing themselves as victims. Oh, life is so hard for me because I'm part of this group, and how awful because the establishment hates me, or the white man hates me, and so on. They just don't think like that, because we never encourage them to think that. We encourage them to be grateful for what they've got and to recognize how much more they might have than somebody else.
Yeah, so I've been thinking about that idea as well, this embedded victimhood and people. They want to show off how victimized they are.
Yeah.
Again, Haidt calls the victim culture. Yeah.
And that's because that's the culture we live in.
Right.
So you get more social status and more social standing the more of a victim you are. But that makes for a pretty unhappy life, where you're always just angry with people, you know, as opposed to thinking strategically about what you're going to do with your life and how you are personally responsible for yourself. So personal responsibility is a big thing that we teach the kids. Personal responsibility, a sense of duty towards other people, the duty towards the whole, right? So you will sacrifice on your behalf,
right.
You sacrifice things for the betterment of the whole. And that you are grateful for what you have. You work hard. You are kind. You do the right thing, even when it's difficult, especially when it's difficult, we say. You know, those, we have lots of little phrases like that. You know, when we say to the kid, if he's got a detention, we say, well, the trust bucket has been knocked over, but now we're going to lighten it up and you're going to start filling the trust bucket again. Because sometimes we make mistakes, but there's always a way of making up for that mistake. And that's by building trust again. And, you know, we know the families very well. We know the children very well. And that creates, well, there is trust between us and kindness. And too often, look, my teachers, we work very hard. You know, we get here early in the morning, 7 a.m. easily. Some of us get here before then. And then we're here till 5, 6 o'clock in the evening. Some of us will stay later than that as well. My teachers are very dedicated and very much they believe in changing the lives of children in the inner city for the better. So we are exceptional in that way. But these ideas, I promise you, could work everywhere. But they also need the values behind. So when you say, why would anybody have a problem with this? Okay, so on the surface, there are people who hate silence. There are people who hate order and structure because they think kids should just be allowed to run free and do whatever they want.
Right.
And I often think that the left get this wrong. They think that, you know, kids, let them go free, let them do what they want. And then when they are adults, that's when they are taking our freedom away. Freedom of speech is curtailed. We're not allowed to think what we want, say what we want. And people are terrified when they're adults. It should actually be the other way around. You curtail their freedom when they're younger so that later they can be truly free. Because true freedom isn't just being able to do whatever you want. It's having the skills and the knowledge that's required to be able to live a truly free life where you can fulfill your ambitions, where you have the skills and the knowledge to find what you love and do what you love. If you haven't had freedoms restricted when you're younger, like no smartphone, like go to bed by 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, like very, you know, supervised access to the laptop and the internet and so on. People look at me, they say to me, oh, you know, you must hate children because you want corridors to be silent. No, I take that freedom from them in order to ensure that they have the possibility of being able to gain those skills and knowledge to make something with their lives later so that they'll be free later. Of course, children aren't free. I mean, they shouldn't be free. I mean, okay. Obviously.
So one of the things that I was thinking of when what percentage or even a maybe it's not a percentage, maybe it's a number of kids do you expel for disciplinary issues?
Very few. No more than the national average. So we have done, you know, permanent. But I mean, I haven't done one for a couple of years at least. I mean, you know, like.
Because I'm always thinking like, what would someone say? So one of the reasons that Chinese test scores are so high is they only allow certain people to take the test.
Yes.
One of the reasons.
Yes, that's not happening here.
Yeah, that's not happening.
Well, I haven't expelled anybody for 2 years, so okay. At least. And we do not have more than the national average, which would be maybe one a year or something, you know. So that does not, you know,
okay.
That doesn't apply here. And it's also the case that they have been given to us by the local council. We have not chosen these kids.
See, that's a key. So they weren't self-selected. I mean, they weren't. So I'll push back on something you said. I cannot fathom that this would work in the United States.
Of course it would.
No, politically.
Well, no.
I don't think there's any political will
to
have
an
institution. I mean,
well,
I think
you just need someone who's crazy enough like me to do it. No. There's no political will here either. This hasn't happened because I've had support. This has happened in spite of the government. This has happened in spite of all the people who hate us because we've had to fight for it.
Even so when they see the outcomes, even when you say, hey, look, here are the outcomes. Here's the neighborhood school. Here are their outcomes.
Yep, that's right. People still campaign to ruin us.
And the reason that I just find this to be, I'm really trying to, that's why I ask if it's the right or the left. I mean, I would think it's the right because they want minorities to fail. I'm trying to think of why someone would be against this.
Look, the right generally tend to be in favor of us. Some of them will feel uncomfortable with silent corridors and so on. But the right do tend to be in favor of us. Although when I speak about restricting children's freedom, you can see them kind of bristle a little. But they tend to be in favor of us because we have a traditional curriculum. We have a traditional approach to education. We're not encouraging the kids to be victims and so on. So the right tend to support us. The left are very much against us because they don't like traditional values. They want a progressive curriculum. So they want it to be decolonized and so on. They want to teach critical race theory. They want to divide children according to groups. And they don't like the fact that we don't do that. They will argue. So what will they argue? They'll say special needs kids can't possibly cope with your school. And my position on that is
it's an unusual argument.
Well, they love it, the special needs kids, because when you teach them in a traditional way, when you have silence in the classroom so that they can hear.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt. Let's back. What do you mean by special needs kids? I think it might mean something different here in the U.S.
No, it means the same thing.
Okay.
Any kind of, I don't know, you're autistic, dyslexic, any of those things.
Okay.
I mean, we've got autistic children here. We've got a couple of kids, one boy who jumps on the ground in the same spot in the playground. I mean, they love it. They love the order and clarity. I mean, the thing is that they can't imagine special needs kids doing well here because their special needs kids are allowed to act out. But the thing is with children, if you pull the fence in tight, they will behave within that fence. As long as you're consistent. So look, one of the reasons why children of divorced families have a harder time being successful in life. Obviously, it's possible to do, and single moms can bring up children well and so on. I'm not saying they can't, but it's more difficult. The reason it's more difficult is because of the inconsistency between the two houses. So if dad is saying, go to bed when you want, and mom is saying, go to bed at 9. If mom is saying, you can be on the smartphone when you want, but dad is saying, no, I'm taking the smartphone away. That inconsistency is poison to a child, and they can't cope with it. And then they spin out of control. That's why children being brought up under one roof, much better idea, because hopefully mom and dad are singing from the same hymn sheet. But I have to say, if they're not, that child will also struggle. So it's the same thing in a school. What tends to happen in schools is that people just let it go. They just say, okay, hire the teachers, you go and do what you like in your own classroom. But when you just let it go like that, there's no consistency. And there's no, like, our school, we are all applying the same methods. We're all having similar conversations with the kids, and we all have similar values. So when you say it's impossible to understand, it's probably because your values are very similar to ours. If your values are, so I gave a talk, and I talked about the same sort of stuff I'm talking to you about now. And this woman got up to me, a white middle-class woman came up to me and said, but what about the racism? Why don't you teach them about racism? And I said, well, I don't think I need to be talking about racism all the time. I want to talk to them about the skills and knowledge that they need to be able to overcome obstacles in their life.
Right.
Some of that may be racism and other obstacles. And she said, but the racism is so bad. You've got to teach them. You've got to teach them. And I said, but I think they're okay. And she kept saying it. And I said, they do know that they're black, you know. That's what I said. I said, they do know. And what they need to know is how to jump over obstacles, how to build resilience, how to build stoicism and perseverance in them and so on. That's what they need. And she got so angry and she marched off on me. And I just thought, you, a white woman, are telling me how bad racism it is. I've worked, one, I'm not white. Two, I've worked in the inner city with brown and black kids all of my life. I know what works, but you're telling me that I'm somehow letting them down by not constantly going on about racism. Now, look, I'll give an assembly about Serena Williams. I'll give an assembly about, Martin Luther King or whatever. But when I do that, I'm not saying life is so hard for Serena Williams. gosh, she's had to fight so hard. What I say is she wakes up at 4 a.m. She goes onto the tennis court.
Exactly.
This is what she eats. This is how she trains. We've got to be like her. It's a very different thing. And what people...
Grit.
I think this is it. Grit's a nice word. You know, what people don't realize is in an effort to demonstrate compassion themselves and to make themselves feel better about their own privileges, they deny the kinds of conversations that they had when they were children to children who need those conversations all the more so. Mm-hmm. So disadvantaged kids, minority kids, etc. And that's because they think that in order to help these kids, they need quotas. You know, well, it's all right. Let them fail at everything. And then when they get to the top, to, you know, finishing up, we'll just let them into the university and we'll give them that diploma because we'll tick that box. And then we'll put them in that company because we'll tick that box. That's no way to live your life. You know, the way to live your life and have a successful life is to work for it. It's to graft. Like, that's what makes life worth living. Trust fund kids all end up committing suicide, or they're high on drugs. They're unhappy, you know, and they're unhappy because they have a trust fund. Now, I'm not saying, obviously, there's a level of poverty that you go below that's unacceptable. So I'm not saying that. But I'm saying you come from an ordinary family. That's where you need to get to a good school. The good school is your ticket, right? It's your ticket right to everything, because your parents don't speak English, or they don't have books at home, or they never take you to the theater and so on. So you are depending on your teachers to change your life for you. And if your teachers are massively unionized and are marching into school saying, I'm not going to stay here past 3 o'clock and I'm not doing this and I'm not doing that and so on and so forth, well, then who is there to save these kids, right? Now, look, I'm not saying teachers shouldn't be paid more. Maybe they should be. I'm not saying teachers don't work in terrible conditions, because they do. You know, the thing is that the leadership in our schools is often lacking. So teachers are battling it out in classrooms where the behavior is so bad.
I know, I've seen it.
There's nothing those, I feel for these teachers. I once went and went to a conference in Florida, I spent a few days with some teachers there. The stories they told me, oh my goodness, it was just horrifying. I felt so sorry for them. And I was giving them advice, but their hearts were broken. Like, they had no more resolve. They'd given up because they'd just been squashed by the system. Mm. And so if the teachers are like that, imagine what the kids are like, you know? But it is possible to do, as you've seen here. And look, not everybody's going to have it as it is here. There are big ticket things you can do in schools to change things for the better. But you have to be willing. Look, I am hated by so many people.
And I just find that to be so.
Look, I don't know if you know about our recent thing about the prayer issue. Like, look,
tell me about that.
I'm literally scared for my life.
Yeah, like, tell me about the prayer thing.
So we have 50% of our kids are Muslim. And when we first started in 2014, we opened the school in 2014 with just year seven, and we've grown the school ever since. We now have 50% of our intake are Muslims. So we've grown our Muslim intake, and we've never had a prayer room. I've always been very clear with families about us not having a prayer room. And, you know, the Muslim families weigh it up and they think, you know, and what?
They don't have to come here, right?
No, okay. They could go somewhere else.
Okay.
And so I tell them, I don't just tell them we don't have a prayer room. I tell them we have silent corridors. I tell them we have family lunch. I tell them all the things that I think might bother them, not just Muslim families. I mean, all the families.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I know we're very different. And so I tell them all of this. And then they come. And they put up with it. You know, the Jehovah Witnesses put up with the fact that we read Shakespeare's Macbeth
for a set text.
They don't like that. Some of the Hindus families have complained about the plates because they touch egg.
Oh, yeah.
And they don't like that, you know. But everybody goes, you know what? It's a multicultural community. It's multi-faith, multiracial. In order for us all to get on, we're going to have to sacrifice. So they sacrifice and it's fine. But last year, we did allow prayer in the yard because we don't have anything against prayer inherently. And in the yard, they're all mixed between races and so on. And I think that's really important. Schools don't think about this stuff. They allow enclaves to create, right? So you're, as I say, LGBT group, black group, etc., as opposed to actively ensuring that kids are mixing with each other. Because that's what schools are meant to do. They're meant to socialize children so that they can be socialized adults who are able to interact with a whole variety of people.
Okay, the prayer thing.
And then the prayer thing. So we allowed them to pray in the yard.
Okay.
A few kids started praying.
And that's the yard right
outside? That's just outside, okay, which is basically a cop-out because we don't have any grass or trees.
Right, okay.
Because we're in the middle of the inner city in an old office block. And because of our ethos, we can't have... First of all, the idea of a prayer room makes no sense because... we have 350 Muslims. I mean, we'd have to have several prayer rooms,
right.
And we don't have the space for that. So then we'd have to allow them into the classrooms as they are. Well, then that would mean removing all their bags and their coats that stay in there now. If kids are just roaming the halls, well, we don't allow kids to roam the halls because we're the strictest school in Britain. So all of our ethos would go out the window if we did that. In the yard, fine. We didn't mind. But what happened was that I suppose people saw us from outside the gates. I don't really know, but a campaign started online. Thousands of people signed this petition. Why don't they have a prayer room? You're a bunch of Islamophobes, etc. Which obviously we're not. I mean, we've grown our Muslim intake from 30% to 50%. My own grandmother was Muslim. Like, it's just a silly thing to say. But the idea is, if we don't get what we want, you're a bunch of Islamophobes. Now, our kids weren't saying that. It was people on the outside. We started getting death threats. We had a bomb threat. Police had to come and search the school. One of my black teachers was so badly racially abused, called the N-word, the C-word, compared to a monkey, all kinds of horrible things that were sent to the school. Both she and I received death threats. She and I had to take cars into school, you know, friends dropping us off and stuff. She was so terrified. So was I terrified. And eventually things calmed down. Why? Because we banned prayer. Now, that was on the outside, coming into the inside. But within the school, what was fascinating is that during Ramadan, some of the children fast. That's fine by us. Some of the children in this particular Ramadan, for 8 years, remember, nobody prayed. We allowed them to pray in the yard, but they never did. And then once the prayer started, more and more kids started praying. And then they would stand by the break hall food table and intimidate Muslims who wanted to eat. They didn't want to fast, and tell them that they were bad Muslims unless they ate the food, right? One girl started wearing a hijab. She didn't cover her head, but suddenly she was made to feel that she ought to. One girl dropped out of the choir because singing is haram. Kids were then being made to pray, or being strongly encouraged, intimidated into it. The whole culture changed in the school. So the governors, that combined with the outside threats, took the right decision, I believe, to abolish prayer. And we did. And, you know, almost instantly, the school went back to normal. I mean, everybody, with the joyful place that you just saw today, which, yeah, you can't believe.
Joyful would be a great word for it.
That place, over that week and a bit, had changed, you know, completely. It was a totally different school. It felt more like a normal school, you know?
And who's giving you these death threats? I mean, is it the usual
random
suspects?
People out there, I don't know. People who were very upset to hear that we didn't have a prayer room. But as I say, we'd have to have lots of prayer rooms. We'd have to change our whole ethos. We could, Michaela, the school as it is incompatible with prayer rituals. So people are allowed to pray in their heads, obviously, but the prayer ritual happening can't take place. And now we've had to go to the High Court, face a judge, and hopefully, I mean, we're waiting for a verdict now. Hopefully, the courts will side with us. But in the meantime, you know, everybody's on tender hooks. I am always worried when I'm on the tube, the subway. I'm looking around me, making sure nobody's near me, because I don't really know what could happen, you know? And that's, well, I think it's an unreasonable amount of stress to put on a head teacher or a principal, you know? We should be able to just run our schools. And ultimately, like you say, how could anybody, honestly, there's so many people who hate me. So many people. I mean, there's the prayer bit, but let's ignore that. Just because, well, one of the big reasons is because we do really well. So I know every August we come out with our results. And every time we come out with the results, and we're really excited about them because they're so good, I say to everybody, you know, brace for impact, tin hats on, take cover. Because I know as soon as I tweet that out, for one day it'll go and it'll be fine. And then the attacks start coming. And the vitriol, I mean, they're horrible, you know?
So two questions. One, who are these attacks from?
Random people on Twitter. But they tend to be people on the left. They don't like what we do because it's traditional. They especially, I would say, don't like a black woman running a school with traditional small C conservative values, because we black people are meant to hold leftist views. And if we don't hold them, then we have betrayed our saviors, our white saviors, who, you know, I don't know, saved us from racism or whatever it is. And I found that when we were setting up the school, actually, it took us 3.5 years to set up the school because it was such a fight. We had to move to 3 different areas in London in trying to set it up. The reason is because I gave a speech at the Conservative Party conference in 2010, where, you know, if you Google Catherine Birbal Singh, you know, Conservative Party speech on YouTube, you will find it. It's only 5 minutes. But in that speech, I talked about black kids failing in school because of what the white liberal does to him. I talked about, I say about kids claiming that they have anger management and all sorts, that it stops them from actually fulfilling their potential because of this victim mentality. I didn't use the word victim, but that was what I was talking about. And I ended up losing my job. Now, look, they didn't fire me, but I resigned. I had to resign in the end because there was so much media scrutiny. I was so hated by the establishment. So this is 2010, just really before being canceled became a thing, but I was essentially canceled. I then had to find an alternative way of trying to make a living. I'd only ever worked in inner city schools, and it's what I love. I could have gone to work in the private sector, but I didn't want to do that. So because I love working with kids who come from more disadvantaged homes. So I ended up setting up my own school. So you guys have had charter schools since the 90s, whereas it was in 2010 that we started having free schools, we call them, but it's the same as charter schools, but we're not in charge of our own admissions. So, you know, that's one thing. Charter schools are different because they have a separate lottery that people apply to, whereas free schools in this country, we are just given our intake by the local council. It took us 3.5 years because I would do an event in, you know, inner city part of London. I would, my whole steering group was with me, and there would be protesters outside with placards calling me a Tory teacher because I'd spoken at the Conservative Party conference, and of course they're called Tories. And so they would shout abuse at me. They sent me racist emails. I mean, just the most awful stuff. And these are people on the left. We had to hire bouncers at one event because we were so worried about the possible violence that would ensue. I would talk to these crowds. Well, I say crowds. I would go out. I'd give out all these leaflets to black mums who would say, oh, yes, I want another choice of school. Thank you. Thank you. They'd come along to the event, and all these white people would have been bussed in from outside of London, who live out in some area where there are no black people. They'd come in, they'd sit amongst those black mums, and then when I'd get up to talk, they would start shouting things in order to drown me out so that the mums couldn't hear me. I remember one woman standing up and saying, you betrayed us when you went to speak at the Conservative Party conference. I'm like, who are you? Betrayed you? I don't even know who you are. But in her mind, she is a white woman of the left, and I betrayed her as a black woman going and speaking at the Conservative Party conference. Now, I have to say, I'm not a conservative. I'm not a member of the Conservative Party. I'm a small C conservative. Unfortunately, I would say there are a whole load of conservatives out there who are not small C conservative. I mean, is Donald Trump a small C conservative? Most definitely not, you know. I am a small C conservative, and that's because I believe in those small C conservative values of personal responsibility, of duty towards others, of family, of belief in one's country, and anyway, various things like that. I have those beliefs. I want very much for the children in my care to have those beliefs. And I would say that one of the reasons, so partly it's because of my color that they attack me so much because I'm meant to think in a particular kind of way and they hate the fact that I don't. And two, I say this stuff. So like I try and expose the left for their racism, because the way in which everything is set up is the right are racist, the left are good people. And that's not true. You know, the fact is there's racism across both the left and the right. I, of course, experience most of it from the left, but of course there is racism on the right too. And the problem I have is that the right never want to recognize racism. So if I talk about my experiences, in fact, we've just seen it. I just saw that Nikki Haley talking about her experiences as being mixed Indian and white growing up, and that some beauty pageant or something she was in, and how they didn't know where to put her because she wasn't black, she wasn't white, what were they going to do with her? And the right, the immediate thing is there's backlash with the right. You know, how dare she talk about racism? You know, she's playing the victim card. No, she's not playing the victim card. She's just describing what her experiences were like when she was a child. And so she's saying she understands what racism is. There's nothing wrong in explaining about racism. But unfortunately, nowadays, because the left have made racism or any kind of, you know, issue that someone might have that's an ism, let's say, because they've made it so ridiculous. When I say ridiculous, what I mean is such a hot potato where everything is racist, you know, people like Ibram Kendi and so on, which is just anti-racism,
right,
which makes everybody racist, you know. they've made it so impossible for anyone to have a sensible conversation around race that the right's reaction is just victim, victim, you're right, you're claiming victimhood, so you can't actually talk about it. And then the people on the left, they only recognize the kind of racism that is not theirs. They only recognize what they think of as right-wing racism. They never look inward and think, well, what things are we doing on the left that are actually really quite racist? Like insisting that all of us black people vote on the left, or insisting that all of us black people hold certain values. Like, why can't we have the freedoms of white people to be able to think the way that we want to think?
All right. So I'm having a lot of problems in this conversation. I'm going to tell you what I'm having problems with, and maybe you can help me understand.
Okay.
Okay. So you have actual data. You have evidence about, for example, test scores. You have actual data about outcomes.
Yes.
This is not the, these are not the musings of deranged people. This is evidence. Like, you have evidence so that an independent neutral observer can look at this evidence with like a discrete number or.
Yes.
Okay. So what I'm having,
I know. It makes no sense.
So.
Look, I used to think, I tell you, when we were setting up the school and fought for so long to do it, I used to think, build it and they will come. That's what I used to think. And to some extent, that's true. We get 800 visitors a year, you know? And there are teachers who have changed their practices in their classroom for the better. But I really thought, I'll build a school and then people will be able to see the things that work and then they'll think, great, and then we'll have a revolution.
Right, right.
That has not happened.
So you have now outcomes of students, and I would assume like test scores, you said.
Yeah.
And you have... I'm looking around and I see, you know, the graffiti on the buildings, et cetera. Yes. And you have...
And the train tracks.
Right, and the train tracks. I saw the teacher screaming.
Yeah, and no yard.
No yard, right.
No grass, no trees, no right. sports hole, nothing.
And you're still producing these outcomes. Mm-hmm. And then I would assume that you have similar... The demographics are similar, and that you have test results and data and outcomes and students percentage to go on to university, et cetera.
Yes.
So is the reaction, do the left react to the data? Do the right react to the data? Do they say, well, I might not like the fact that they have silent corridors?
They tend to accuse us. They'll say, you've handpicked your intake. Well, that's impossible. It's illegal. I'd be in prison. Like, I can't handpick. It's the council that gives us our intake.
Right.
So they make up lies about us.
Do they speak to you directly about
no.
it?
No. So this will be on Twitter and things. Okay, no, they never speak to me directly. And they never come to visit either.
Neither the right nor the left, or just
one of
those?
No. Conservative people come here all the time. And teachers come here. So no, some teachers who are lefty teachers would come here and see the school. But the people who hate us will never visit.
So the people who criticize you on the left, they don't... Are they willing to have conversations with you about it?
No. No.
And their emails haven't just got lost.
What? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, it's an inside joke for real.
Oh.
Okay.
Right.
So,
okay.
So they won't talk to you. They refuse to have a conversation with you. Yet you have the data.
Well, they'll have conversations on Twitter.
Okay, well,
where
that's
they just
not a conversation.
You.
Right.
They just
that's
insult me and call me names.
That's
and
not a conversation.
Rude. Right, right, right.
Okay. So.
No, they're not willing to look at what we do. They're just not willing. They say things like, I want the media spotlight, I'm self-obsessed, or they say...
Imagine that.
Well, me who comes into school every day at 6:45 a.m.
Right.
to run a school for a bunch of kids, you know? Like, you know, at first when we started this, they all said, because I'd spoken at the Conservative Party conference, they all said that I definitely wanted to be a politician. That was why I was doing what I was doing. they soon had to abandon that accusation.
I think
that would
be a great idea if you became a politician. But anyway, they abandoned that.
The fact is, they had to. So they're always accusing me of different things.
Right.
But then in the end, obviously, I didn't want to be a politician because I'm still in school. I mean, they say all sorts of things. The only reason why you're succeeding is because government is helping you. Well, in which way is government helping us? You know, they've blocked everything we've tried to do. So obviously they're not helping us.
So wouldn't the response to that be, well, let's replicate this model and have government help other people so we can replicate we can have similar results?
Look, there are a small number of people on the left who think like that. So I wouldn't want to say that everyone on the left is against what we do. There are some who are supportive of us, who like what we do, and then they copy us in their own schools and so on, or they argue for us. So we have supporters on Twitter who are people of the left who will argue with the people who are further on the left to say, look, they're doing a good job, leave them alone. I am constantly put in the press by things that we do. So this prayer issue is one thing. We wanted a media ban. There was a media ban, which we argued for, you know, as best we could in court. But then the judge decided to lift the media ban and allowed the press to name both me and the school. They're not allowed to name the teachers or the girl or the mother. But look, he had to weigh up my interests against the public interest and power to the people through the press. You know, I kind of get that. And there is huge public interest in this story. But it does put me at risk. And it also throws me into the limelight where I'm forced to defend what we're doing in terms of prayer. But there are other times when I've been thrown into the limelight so many times because what we do is so sort of scandalous. You know,
scandalous in what way?
Well, banning prayer, for instance, or having silent corridors. That was a big deal at the time. Or being vegetarian. So we're vegetarian.
That lunch I ate was vegetarian?
Yes.
No kidding. I was wondering what that mystery meat was. Now I know. It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's vegetarian because we want the children to be able to sit at tables where there are Muslim kids and Hindu kids and so on. But if you eat meat but no pork, meat but no beef, everybody's eating different things, it can't work. In a multicultural and multi-faith and multiracial society, if you want that to work, you have to actively make it work. And the problem with the West, I find, America, with here in Britain as well, you know, you just allow people to just be any which way. And look, this is my problem with the libertarian. So look, as much as obviously I believe in freedom and I'm against cancel culture, I was canceled myself, so I'm not arguing for that. Yeah. The libertarian doesn't understand that when you just say, everybody do whatever you want, freedom for all, the problem with that is that that leaves a culture vacuum and a leadership vacuum in any country. And that vacuum gets filled by the extreme left. That's what happens. And so when the libertarian looks around and says, why are all these kids being taught to hate themselves, white kids being taught to hate themselves in schools? Or why are all these black kids being taught that this isn't their country or whatever? When that happens, it's because the libertarian argued for absolute freedom. Now, freedom is good, but you need to have social cohesion within that freedom. And you need to have some social conservative values that enable us and to do the right things.
And what do you mean by that?
So what I mean by that is, if it's just everybody be free, do whatever you want, well, you know what? Men, they tend to like having lots of women. That's like biologically, right? That's what they enjoy. And if there is no social pressure around them to say, look, it's quite nice to get married and stay married for your whole life, and this is something that you ought to do for the sake of your children, for instance, men are less likely to do it. So one of the reasons why there are fewer and fewer people getting married and more people getting divorced is because there is this sense of, well, I'm free. I can do whatever I like. And people used to have a sense of shame. There used to be a sense of, I need to go and see my grandmother, not because I really want to see my grandmother right now, but because I ought to, because it's the right thing to do. You know, I'm going to go to church or whichever institution, you know, religious institution you want, not necessarily because I really, really want to,
right,
but because I ought to, because this is what I do. It's the ritual. Every Sunday I get up and I put on my Sunday best and I go to church and I take a humble position in the world. Now, look, I'm not a Christian. I'm one of those people who's free, right? I'm free to not be religious and so on. But I'm just questioning the wisdom in all of this, because the rituals that we used to have as a community, going to Sunday, you know, wearing your Sunday best, going to church, or having dinner with your family every evening, and everyone eating together and sharing stories, as opposed to everybody just being on their phone and doing their own thing.
So the corrosion of those rituals has had a deleterious effect on society.
Yeah, it breaks us all apart. And it stops us from, we just all think it's all about freedom. And look, I don't want to argue against freedom, especially in this culture of trying to clamp down on freedom, in particular for adults. And like I say, the left get it the wrong way around, where the children are allowed to be as free as they like, and the adults are stopped from being free. But freedom only works in an environment where we're able to agree on the shared values, and we're able to look down on each other if we behave badly, you know?
Yeah. So one of the things I asked our tour guides was if there's bullying in the schools, and they said no. And then I asked them, like, how are gay people? Are they, you know, how are the gay kids treated here? And she was like, what?
I was thinking, I wonder what she said.
Yeah. She was like, she was just thought it was a bizarre question. Like, they're not treated any differently than anybody else. I mean, that's the interpretation that I got, though she wasn't explicit in that. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, the kids are kind to each other.
Yeah.
They're taught to be kind and to mix with each other across sexuality, across race, across religion, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So they don't really think about it. And they won't be thinking, you see how, the reason why I should have been confused, should have been thinking, well, I don't know. There's no group of gay kids.
Yeah, exactly.
If you'd said, well, what about the black kids? She would have thought, well, there's no group of black kids.
Right.
There's no group of Chinese kids. I don't really think about these sorts of things because we're all just kids together.
And you think one of the left, that's the problem with having people who won't speak to you about, because you don't really know what their criticisms are. But so we have to kind of figure out what their criticisms are, even though we don't know what exactly they are. So do you think the problem is that the left is upset that at this school, the kids aren't breaking into identity groups?
Well, that's too specific. Yes, that's one of the things that they won't like, but...
Yeah, no, like, would that be a problem?
Oh,
like,
yeah,
they
definitely
think that, like, we should have a contingent
definitely
of, like...
It's like that woman saying to me, but you've got to tell them about racism. And I was saying, no, I really don't need to be talking about racism. That is not something... You see, what I always say to black people?
Yeah.
Whenever black people are saying, we need more black history in schools, we need black culture taught, etc., I'm always saying to them, you really want black culture to be taught by a 23-year-old white woman? Is that what you want?
Yeah.
Why aren't you just teaching your own kids your own stuff? Like, the fact is, you come from different homes, you might eat different foods, you might have different religions, but you don't depend on the school to teach your stuff. Schools are meant to teach algebra. We're meant to teach Shakespeare. We're meant to teach the history of the country that you've grown up in, you know? And geography and science and so on. That's what schools are meant to do. I don't understand this idea that schools are meant to be teaching all about the various isms and the culture wars. Well, we're not talking, we don't talk about the culture wars here. We're talking too busy teaching algebra. And so I know you were saying, oh, you know, it looks like when you're going around that they have a great curriculum. Our kids know more than any kid out there. Okay. Like, they are so impressive. Honestly, I don't talk to them about history because they know more about history than I do. I'm serious. Like, they know, gosh, I mean, they're just so knowledgeable and so clever. And that's because their teachers have taught them so well. And
and again, to hammer this home, this is not a magical thing. There's a mechanism behind this that can be duplicated.
Yes, absolutely.
This one of the sticking points would be there would have to be a value for people to want to know certain things, like Edie Hirsch.
Yes.
Yeah.
So yes, Edie Hirsch. So there we go. So okay. Edie Hirsch, when I lost my job and all of that happened, Edie Hirsch, I read Edie Hirsch for the first time.
Yeah.
And thought, where has this man been all my life?
Right, right.
And I had the pleasure, honor of my life to go to a conference in Amsterdam some years ago. A few years ago, and I gave a talk, and Edie Hirsch also gave a talk.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, he was 91 at the time. So And when I got off the stage, he came up to me and gave me a kiss.
Oh, wow.
You know, because he was so thrilled by what I was saying, you know? And because, you know, he's a man who writes books, whereas I'm the practitioner on the ground doing it.
Right.
And here I was saying that what he says works, you know? And it so works, you know?
So summarize what it is that works.
Edie Hirsch. So, you know, he has various books. The Knowledge Deficit is one of his books. Kids don't know anything. Especially the poorer they are, the more inner city they are and so on. Mm. Gosh, go and ask them. You know, American kids, my goodness, do they know where Europe is? Do they know? They don't know anything.
I don't think they know where Canada is, less of 40%. Exactly. 40%, yeah.
And the reason why they don't know that is because nobody's taught it to them, because they're in classrooms where nobody's learning anything.
Mm. And they're learning about race and gender and trans status. So they're learning about
that. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Why are we teaching this stuff? That should not be taught. You only have a certain amount of time in the school day. There's not enough time to do all the teaching of the different subjects that we need to teach them. So it's because, it's what you said before, if you don't value that knowledge,
right,
then you think, what's the big deal? I also think that adults overestimate their own, like, the lack of knowledge they had.
And they overestimate
what kids know.
Yeah.
So when you say to them, kids don't know where Paris is, over here, that, you know, Paris is next door, or they don't know the capital of France, people say, oh, come on, of course they know that. And we say, no, they really don't.
Yeah.
If you don't teach it to them, how are they meant to know? So that what Edie Hirsch is arguing against is the idea that kids just know stuff.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
people just assume that the knowledge is inside the child. And this started with Rousseau, the idea
started
of drawing.
Plato, but yeah, I started with Socrates, but yeah, go ahead.
Yes, sorry, true. Yeah. But Rousseau's made it popular, this idea of pulling the knowledge out of the child.
Yeah, yeah.
And this idea that you are not the whatever it is, the sage on the stage.
Yes, yes.
You're the guide on the side.
Right, right.
You know? And so people then, teachers are then facilitators of learning. I'm the guide.
Direct instruction,
So the opposite of direct instruction. Yeah, so direct instruction is, I'm telling you what you need to know.
Yep.
The guides on the side are saying, you all teach each other. This is child-centered learning.
Kind of more constructivist pedagogical.
That's right. Model. So over the last 40, 50 years, that's been going on. But you didn't notice it so much in the 80s because it hadn't been going on that long. But, you know, like when Whitney Houston talks about children are our future, she just sang that song. Nowadays, and she says, let them lead the way is what she follows with, right? So I believe very much that children are our future. I just don't think they should be leading the way. We as adults need to lead the way. So I started off by saying adult authority. We've lost adult authority. So she sang that song in 1980-something. Nowadays, that's the mantra. Children should lead. So children are leading in schools. And I would argue that actually one of the reasons why we have all of this victimhood stuff and critical race theory and all the rest of it is precisely because children are leading, right? So when you have children leading, they are looking for the excuses to excuse why they haven't done their homework, to excuse why, you know, I remember when George Floyd happened, which, I mean, we could get into all the business of it, you know, Chauvin didn't even actually kill him, you know. I mean, anyway, when I think of that summer and the madness that went on, here in Britain, kids at Oxford University, black kids, were told that they could get an extension on their exams and so on because of George Floyd's death. What does George Floyd have to do with us? It is just crazy. Now,
it certainly is.
And it's this claim of victimhood that then prevents real conversations around racism from happening.
Yeah, yeah.
The conversation I was saying, where I was saying, isn't it interesting? I get a very different reaction to white people who, so there was a white guy here, Toby Young, who set up
a conversation with him. Yeah.
Right. So he set up a school, similar idea of knowledge being central to it and so on. Yeah. He didn't get the pushback I got. He didn't get people protesting outside his open events. He didn't get anything like the kind of hatred that I got. And why is that? Because he's a white guy. So white guys are allowed to be conservative. Black woman is not allowed to be, you know, but I can't then say that without the right saying to me that I'm claiming to be some kind of victim. Look, am I a victim? Have I let anything stop me? No, I keep going. But it's also interesting to see how it's not just the right that can be racist, it's the left that can be racist. And the left will never accept that. And I find that too many black people, you know, they're just sort of, they're still in that mindset of thinking that the way forward for us is to believe in the left mantra, when in fact the leftist mantra has completely destroyed us. You know, when I think about the welfare state and the damage it's done, and obviously I'm not arguing for children to be starving on the street, and I'm obviously not arguing for there to be no catch at all.
Yeah.
But we can see when we look at the stats on marriage rates for the black family, you can see that in America and how that was completely destroyed by Johnson and the introduction of the welfare state. We can see how it's the mentality. I mean, I've worked with this all my life in the inner city, where kids, I mean, not here, because obviously we're very different, but before working here or before setting up the school, it was the case that I would meet kids all the time in the inner city, girls who would say to me, oh, well, you know, maybe I could get pregnant and then I'll get a free flat and that kind of thing. Like, it was something that they would talk about as an option, you know, for them. Where mums would come to me, gosh, I remember mums regularly coming to me and saying how the local council would make them do parenting classes because their kid was spinning out of control. And the council would be giving them advice to only praise their child and never punish their child. So they were giving them, and the mothers would be saying to me, but how can I praise her when she's doing all the wrong things? This is crazy, you know? Like, so the state, in many ways, not just by giving out welfare, by giving out advice, by setting various norms for families, right? By taxing people if they are living together. So when you're taxed more as a couple and you're better off if you split, well, then it ensures that families are split apart by the state. There are so many ways in which the state undermines the stuff that helps people. So if you look at Chinese kids and think, why do they do really well? Well, guess what? They tend to be raised in two-parent families. They tend to work really hard. They tend to not see themselves as victims. They tend to have an Eastern mindset, which I referred to at the beginning, which is, you know, if a kid... Once I said this at a conference, if a Western kid struggles at something and works really hard for it and gets it, the parent will say, well done, you're really clever.
Good job.
And they'll say, you're really clever, is what they'll say. They'll celebrate his brains.
Right.
The Eastern kid, I'd said in this conference, I said, if a Chinese kid does that, works really hard, the parent will say, well done, you worked really hard. So that means when the kid then comes across another situation that he finds difficult.
Yeah.
The Eastern kid thinks, if I work hard, I'll get it. And the Western kid thinks, am I clever enough to do this?
And what does the black kid think?
Well, if the black kid has been told, well done, blah, blah, he'll also think the same thing as the white kid. But if the black kid has been told by the media and by everybody that life is so difficult for him and the man is against
him, the system is set up against him,
then why is he going to work? He's not going to do his homework. So I've seen this all my life. What is the point of working if the system is set up against you? And the only way you can make it in life is if you work really hard as a kid.
Right.
Now, look, I could have gone into the private sector. So for people watching this thinking, oh, you know, she's some right-wing loon. Look, every day I'm in school at 6:45 a.m. I've been doing this for 25 years, only ever working in the inner city with kids from disadvantaged backgrounds.
So I'm just telling you something. Like, I'm telling you, we cannot listen to these people anymore. They have literally nothing to contribute whatsoever.
Yes.
They won't have conversations. They have nothing to contribute. I'm completely done with them.
Yeah.
So I'm we can just wipe that off
the
table.
Say
they're
that
in make-believe land. They're playing with each other in make-believe land.
Yeah, but you say that. So many of them are teachers.
Okay.
So in my field, I can't just wipe them off. I have to engage. I have to try and persuade them. Because if I don't persuade them, then all of these kids, in particular the more disadvantaged kids, are being failed. And I have persuaded some of them. That has happened. And I know why you say, forget it, we can't deal with these people. And I know that in America, there are some of those people who are just off the charts crazy. You know, I know that's the case. But there are some people, there's a whole bunch of people. So there's the off the charts crazy people. But there's a whole bunch of people here who are on the left who are just, the Overton window has been moved.
Right.
So they've been pulled in that direction. And they don't want to be seen as bad people.
Right.
You know, they put the black box up on Instagram because they feel that they ought to. And they... they just don't talk about trans issues because they don't want to, you know, they just don't want to be seen to be some kind of bigot, you know?
Do you think they value evidence? Like, I'm again coming back to the outcomes of the school. Because if they were sincere, thoughtful, honest people, they would look at the evidence and have a conversation.
Yes. Thing.
They would have a conversation about what the evidence is. And I would, my argument to you would be, it is irrelevant whether this is on the right and the left. What is the outcome?
Yes. Yes. And there are people who think like that. And then they look at us and then they...
Well, that's how everybody should think. What's the evidence?
Yeah.
And it... Is the earth warming from carbon? Or is it anthropogenic? Then we can talk about what to do about it from policy prescriptions. Then maybe conservative. But like the evidence should never be politicized. It should just be what are the outcomes of the school? What are the test scores? How many kids come
here?
How many?
Yeah, but you say that because all of our values are small c conservative. Now, the thing is, it used to be the case that the left had those small c conservative values. So my father, very much a man on the left, comes from Guyana in South America, was friends with their president, Chetty Jagan at the time, a communist. You know, like these are outright communists.
Yeah.
But my father's very much a small C conservative. The reason why I'm a small C conservative is I was brought up in a small C conservative household, which frankly, I have to say, a lot of black people in America, Caribbean people, they are small C conservatives. They are naturally small C conservatives. Mm. The stuff I'm talking about, those values are their values. Mm. But then... we've all been hoodwinked into thinking, well, you have to vote Democrat or you have to vote Labor over here, when in fact that's not the case. Now, look, the reason that's happened is because in the 50s and 60s and so on, it was the left that was fighting for us. There's no question, you know. My father aligned himself with the left because those were the people who made his... who fought for better rights for him, you know. So I get that. I get that point. But the thing is, we're still caught up in this idea that people are just fighting for their rights, you know, but we're not back in civil rights. You know, that isn't the case anymore. We're inventing stories to fight against, like Smollett and, you know,
yeah.
Other situations like that where people are just, I say situations like that, where they're making a much bigger deal out of one small little thing, you know.
Or fabricating it entirely.
Or fabricating it. And all of you have really been harmed, I suppose, by the whole affirmative action stuff. You know, I sort of understand why affirmative action was done in the day, because America wanted to redress things. But the fact that anyone would be against it stopping now, anyone who would be for affirmative action now, I don't understand how black people are happy to take a position knowing that they didn't deserve it. And
then other people would be suspect.
I can't bear it. And the thing is, what then happens is that then is, it hurts those of us who do deserve it.
Right.
So look at how Howard I've worked to put this place together. Look how amazing it is. And yet people will come up to me and say, we'd love you to join our board because we really need it to be more diverse. And I think, do you know who I am? Do you know everything I've achieved? Why can you not see me for me? But they can't see me for me because they've been taught to only see color. And right. So I honestly feel... in 1995, we had better race relationships with people than we do now. And that I wasn't treated like this. Yes, in 1995, people would come up to me and say, ooh, your hair, isn't it great? Now it's a microaggression and nobody would ever touch my hair. Well, you know what? I'd rather they touched my hair than put me on a board for being diverse. You know, when people used to touch my hair, who cares? So they touched my hair. They didn't have hair like mine. So yeah. I mean, I used to say, yeah, go ahead. I mean, what do I care? I mean, I don't understand why that is a bigger issue than making everybody, and then having everybody see everybody through the prism of race. I mean, you know, where you get at a school, you get offers for work experience, you know, in a law firm or whatever it is. Go and spend a couple of weeks. And they say, but this must be for a black child. And then I'm having conversations with my senior team going, well, is so-and-so black? Does he look black enough? What is black? How can we make... And in the end, I'm just like, you know what? I don't even want this. I don't want the... Don't give me the opportunities for just black kids. Because you put me in an impossible situation where I'm having to... I can't do that. I can't look at children and think, are you black? Are you white? Are you this? Are you that? I can't do it. I just... It's so messed up. It's so messed up. And I don't understand how these anti-racist people don't understand that they are racist.
Right.
I don't get it. And that they're not helping black people. They're not helping black kids, you know, or brown kids. Brown and black kids are suffering because of this madness, because what they need is to be told, work hard, make yourself into something, and then you'll live a life that's worth living. Because you don't have to be a billionaire to have a successful life, right? You can be a teacher and live a wonderful life. You could be a doctor and live a wonderful life. You do not have to be the CEO of some bank where you're earning a fortune, you know? And then there's this idea of, well, the only way we can all be happy is if there's equal number of certain races in certain institutions. Why does there have to be an equal number? What do we care? What matters is the kind of life that we lead, you know? What matters is, have I been kind? Have I worked hard? Have I made sacrifices? Have I taken personal responsibility? Do I have a sense of duty towards other people? That's what makes your life worth living. And that's what I try and teach the kids. That's what we all try and do.
Boy, the million-dollar question I have is, how do we help people value those things? We know that those things are tied to outcomes that lead to individual flourishing.
Yes.
I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, we have to start with our schools. What people don't understand, first of all, we need people, before we even do that, we need people to understand how important schools are. Nobody cares about them. People just think about their own kids and they think, if I get him into this private school, he'll be okay. Well, first of all, I'm here to tell you that the private schools are on fire, right? The private schools have more critical race theory than the public schools. The private schools are crazy, okay? They're just crazy because they're all guilty about their privilege. And so the only way they can feel less guilty is by bringing in loads of critical race theory books and teaching the kids to hate themselves and all the rest of it. It's just mad. If you put your child into the private school, you're taking your life into your hands, you know? It's actually getting to a point where you can't go anywhere without seeing this sort of stuff. But in a way, I'm pleased that that sort of happened. The critical race theory debate has happened, because before that, look, I have for a decade and a half been talking about this stuff. I've been shouting and screaming about child-centered learning. I've been shouting and screaming about
phonics, I bet.
You know, about
phonics.
Oh, yeah, phonics, exactly. I've been shouting and screaming about the children leading the way instead of the adults, about the fact that we're not teaching British history properly. I was shouting about here in this country. Nobody's been listening to me. Parents now have only taken an interest now that race is on the cards and trans is on the cards. Those two things have made people sit up and take notice. Before that, nobody cared. And nobody cared because nobody cares about schools. Nobody cares about the importance that they have and the impact that they have on the future of a country. If you care about your country, you have to care about the schools. And I keep saying this. Nobody's listening to me. And they're not listening because once they've got their kid into school, look, this is most parents. Get them into a decent enough school. He'll be all right. Comes home at the end of the day. How's your day? Fine. Great. You got some homework? Go do your homework. That's it. I'm always thinking, how do you know it's the right homework? How do you know what the homework is? How do you know how much homework it is? How do you know what levels he's met? You're just assuming that the school knows what they're doing. You have absolutely no idea. How do you know his day was nice? His day, yeah, it was fine. How do you know it was fine? How do you know he wasn't beaten up? How do you know he wasn't bullied? You have no idea. And the reason you have no idea is because that's what kids say when they come home. It was fine. They're teenagers. They don't want to talk to their parents. And because the parents are busy, well, they don't.
I know.
Indeed. If you don't know what's going on in your child's school, I'm telling you, crazy stuff is going on, right? Nobody listens to me. I got up in 2010 and said that. The whole world, you know, they all went mad. Yeah. Now, there were some people who thought, brilliant, she said something, right? They were in the minority. Now, over time, I have built up more of a following. The school... The fact that I'm known now for the school and people know that, more and more people have come on board with it. But this prayer stuff, there are few teachers out there. In fact, I can't think of a single one who's defending us.
Okay. You've been very generous with your time and I appreciate it. And I just have two more questions.
Sure.
So we have a pretty significant international audience who's going to be listening to this. And I want to specifically ask you, if there's an educational administrator or a teacher in what in the United States we say K through 12, listening to this, can you give them, the educational administrator and the teacher, mm-hmm. 2 to 3 things that they could do, specific things that they could do to help?
Definitely. Okay, so the first thing you need to get is the behavior. If kids aren't behaving, then the teachers can't teach. So line them up outside. Get them to face the front. Get them to, if you can, get them to walk into the school in silence. Now, that means teachers being out and about. Now, you might not be able to do that bit. At the very least, they need to come into the classroom and have a system of sitting down and being silent. And if they're not silent, you need a system of being able to throw them out of the class. Kids, look, teachers.
Yeah, that's.
You need to be able to throw them out. You need to be able to put them somewhere. Because if you can't put them anywhere, then the kids are going to, well, they're not going to listen to you, right? Kids want to be in the group. They don't want to be separated from the group. If you do that consistently, over time, you will move the school to a point where all the kids are then listening to you. Now, they need to make, you need to make sure that they have something worth listening to. So the teaching needs to be good. So you need teachers who are planning their lessons and who are explaining things carefully. Now, I mean, I could speak to you for 5 days about the quality of explanations and what it needs to look like, but you need to make it accessible to them and you need to check for understanding. Number one thing. Okay, can somebody tell me what I've just said? Can somebody just say, what have I just told you to do, right? So everybody hears it. You say it 2 or 3 times so that everybody can get down with the work. Now, the homework that you give them needs to refer to the stuff you have just taught them. Don't give them projects. Don't give them research. Don't give them things that their parents have to do for them. Give them drill on what you've just taught them, because then it drills them into their heads, because kids aren't going to remember. Right. Teachers across the world in staff rooms are saying, I can't understand why they don't remember it. I taught it to them. You have to teach them 10 times.
Right.
You got to drill, right? Drill, there's such a thing as, they call it drill and kill. That's wrong. That's what Edie Hirsch is arguing against, right? If you don't drill something, you're not going to know it.
Right.
It's very simple. How do you learn another language? By drilling yourself in the vocabulary. So you have to drill them with the homework is drilling what you've just learned, so they know exactly how to do it. You cannot give them homework that they're not going to understand. And then you explain, you check for understanding, and you sort the discipline. Now, discipline often can be sorted by going after the small stuff. If you have a charter school and you can have a uniform, then great, you know, because then
I noticed the uniforms and the badges.
The badges. And you'll notice that not a single tie is down.
I noticed that.
Now, that's because to rebel here, your shirt might be left slightly untucked. And if you get away for a couple of hours with your shirt untucked, you're a bad boy here. Now, what that means is, because we've made it into a big deal, shirts tucked in, ties to the top, that's a big deal. So the bad boys can rebel by untucking the shirt, right? Now, if you do that, it means they don't have to bring in knives to rebel. If everything goes and there's freedom for all, well, in order to be the bad boy, you've got to bring a knife in. But if you can be a bad boy simply by untucking your shirt or by making a noise in the corridor because nobody talks, you know, so once my deputies came running to me, Catherine, we've got a situation. And I said, what's the situation? And they said, they're humming in the corridors. I thought, I'll take that. If that's their rebellious act, I'll take that, you know. The thing is, you've got to draw the fence in tightly so that when they rebel, it's within that fence.
So for educational administrators, then what?
Well, that's what they need to be honest. I mean, if I could, the whole of the American system is screwed up. The reason why it's screwed up is because you all think in this way of teachers, administrators. That doesn't happen here. Here, you know, I'm the only person in this building that doesn't teach. All of my deputy heads who are would-be administrators in America, they all teach. And you move your way up through teaching as opposed to going off and doing some idiotic bureaucratic qualification and then coming back in as an administrator, right? We don't have anything like that. We just move our way up through teaching. First, you might become a second in charge of a department. Then you become a head of department. Then you become an assistant head. Then you become a deputy head. And then you become a head. Whereas there, you actually leave the classroom. You leave the school to go off and do some bureaucracy and then come back as some pen pusher with a clipboard. It's crazy, which is one of the reasons why the charter schools are so much better than the public schools.
Interesting.
Because they are people who really believe in it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we set up the school. We own it. It's ours, you know, and it has our particular brand of education.
Do you give internships for people here, like people who want to teach? Because it seems like it'd be an incredible opportunity for people who want to go into teaching. But
yeah,
also
but
a ton
small.
Of work. Yeah,
that's
a ton
thing.
Of work.
We're just so small. But look, I tried to do that. Tried to set up a leadership course, which would have been funded by government. They blocked us. Like everything I've tried to do, we've been stopped from doing it. Now look, in the end, I have satisfied myself with being the show pony. People come, they learn from us, they take it back to their classrooms. People listen to me on a podcast, they go, oh, that's interesting, let me try that out in my classroom. I go and do conferences in places and to teachers, and I give advice about what to do. And they listen and they do stuff, and it makes a difference to their classrooms.
What, final questions. I know we're over and I apologize. What do you do for your free time? Do you have any free time? What do you do with yourself when you're not here?
I don't know. I like watching films.
Oh, what do you like?
Any number of films. I want to go and see that film, The Holdovers.
Oh, yeah.
About
yeah.
a teacher, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I watch films. I might see some friends.
This would have to be an all-consuming life thing.
It is a bit all-consuming. That's true. But that's always been the case. I love education. I sit on the subway on the tube and I'll watch a mom with her child and I'll see him take out the smartphone and I want to go up to her and say, take away the smartphone. You know, I'm always watching children everywhere.
That's how I feel when I see people smoking around their kids.
Right. Yes, indeed. Yeah. So I'm obsessed with kids and obsessed with education. That's my thing. I love it. So I don't see this as work, really.
Yeah. But my other question is, so what keeps you going here? I mean, despite all these obstacles and death threats and lunatics.
The children. Not just our children. I mean, all children. Yeah. I spent most of my career, I suppose, in inner city schools, seeing children fail time and time again. And they were good inner city schools, frankly, the ones I was in. I visited schools where, you know, it's hell on earth. I don't understand. We spend 90 billion a year, more than 90 billion on education. I don't understand how it is that a country can spend so much money on education and not produce excellent schools all over, you know? And I know why that is, because of the values, because of the ideologies, because all the things that we've discussed. So I'm just trying to, make a difference.
Yeah, I think you've done that and then some.
Thank you, I'm trying.
So how can people learn more about the school, Michaela? Where can people go?
Well, there's my Twitter, Miss Snuffy.
What is it again?
Miss Snuffy. So it's Miss with a underscore Snuffy, S-N-U-F-F-Y. But that's short for Snuffleupagus. You'll remember from Sesame Street, Mr. Snuffleupagus?
Yes, I do.
And in the day, I set up a blog called To Miss With Love, like the Sidney Poitier film To Sir With Love. And I called myself Miss Snuffleupagus because it was the big elephant in the room, And then over time on my blog, this is before Twitter and all that, people started calling me Miss Snuffy. So then when I set up my Twitter, I stuck with Miss Snuffy.
Oh, okay.
So they can find me on Twitter, but there's loads of, I don't know, interviews I've done or things I've written, articles I've written that people can read. There's our website, the Michaela website, that people can go on to if they want to see about the school.
Do you know what's the name of that?
And then there's the documentary.
The documentary.
I would strongly recommend.
What's the name of the documentary?
Strictestheadmistress.com.
Okay.
If you go to
And that's you.
And that's me.
Wow. Yeah.
In fact, if you type into Google, who is the strictest teacher in the world, my name comes up.
Wow. Wow. That's fantastic. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, Catherine, thank you so much for talking to us. I sincerely appreciate it. Thank you so
much.
Thank
you. Thanks for having me.
That's great. Thank you for watching. Everything we do is under the umbrella of the National Progress Alliance, nationalprogressalliance.org. It's a nonprofit, independent 501c3. Your generous donations keep us going and keep fueling content like this. So please help us out, make a donation. We very much appreciate it. Thank you.